Resisting the New World Order. The Reformation Society seeks to look at how we can change society. As Time magazine once complained, these Calvinists want to change everything, which is true. And the Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism wants to look at the stories behind the stories, what isn't on the mainstream, lamestream news. What is the New World Order and how can we resist it? Revelation 17 verse 14. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them, because he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. In 2 Chronicles 19 verse 2 we read, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. The first attempt to establish a new world order was by the people who came to the land of Shinar, present-day Iraq, and built the Tower of Babel, which we read about in Genesis 11. Interestingly, Bruegel painted the most famous painting of the Tower of Babel, and you'll see that the EU Parliament in Strasbourg, which I've been to, is self-consciously modelled on the Tower of Babel, right down to the scaffolding and the incomplete building. And if you thought this was sheer accident, look at the poster the EU produced. Europe, many tongues, one voice. And look, they've got a modernized version of, from Bruegel's painting, where you've got the people, the kings and so on, making the plans and building, and they've got the scaffolding there and everything else. And look at the stars. Those, of course, the European Union stars. But instead of having the point pointing upright, they've got the main point pointing downwards in the shape of the goat's horns, ears, and the goat's beard, which is actually a pentagram occultic symbol when it's put in this format. And then they've used the term Europe, many tongues, one voice. What are they saying? We are reversing Babel. God's judgment on Babel to disperse, to fill the earth. They're trying to, no, we want to centralize. God wants decentralization. They want centralization. As seen in the pharaohs, top-down pyramid structure, Nineveh, Babel, Egypt under pharaohs. That's what the EU wants. That's what the New World Order wants. That's what the African Union wants. That's what the United Nations wants. It's a direct fist in the face of God. Nimrod's rebellion seen in the Tower of Babel, and Europe is now speaking in a very antichrist, literally antichrist way. And you can't miss it. You can't mistake it. And just in case you did mistake it, they have outside the Brussels EU headquarters a woman riding a beast. Not just one, they've actually got two. I mean, here's one, a woman riding a beast, which is a very Revelation symbol. Here's another one. This is directly outside the EU office in Brussels. And here's another picture of a woman riding a beast. So what are they saying? The imagery is just unmistakably antichrist. They are just shaking the fist of rebellion in God's face. And today, I think this is just one of the symbols of the New World Order, which is trying to work against God's laws. For example, our friends in Romania, who had come out of decades of communist persecution, said the worst thing they did was join the EU. They said, it's like being back in the Warsaw Pact. We had a few years of freedom, Bible in schools, prayer in government and everything like that, and then suddenly we joined the EU and, oh, but you've got to legalize abortion, you can't have Bible and prayer in schools. And they said the freedoms that we had lost under communists, we regained by overthrowing Ceausescu, now they're trying to take away from us as we joined the EU. Well, just in case you think that's a mistake, look at this EU poster. We all share the same star. What's at the top of the star? Hammer and sickle. Oh, there's a cross there. But I mean, there's Islam and Taoism and Judaism and all kinds of weird paganistic things around there. But the hammer and sickle's all over the place. But the hammer and sickle's right up top, eh? Isn't that interesting? We all share the same star. Well, others have tried to build a new world order. Nebuchadnezzar tried with his Babylonian Empire. The Persians tried, although they came a crop at Marathon, which is what inspired the Marathons of today, and Thermopylae, 300 Spartans. Alexander the Great tried with his Greek or Macedonian Empire to create a new world order. The Roman Empire, of course, almost succeeded, They tried very hard. And Genghis Khan, the Mongols, well, they seem to have destroyed everything. But in fact, something in the region of 12% of the world's population were killed by the Mongols in the space of half a century. Phenomenal destruction by the Mongol hordes. Napoleon attempted to establish at least a European order. The Communist International actually controlled one-third of the world's land surface and population at the height of the Cold War. Revelation 13 describes a beast with many heads and horns, and the dragon gave the beast power, a throne, and great authority. The beast mouthed blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. Who dwells in heaven? Well, aside from the angels and God, the saints, those who have been faithful to God on earth, are blasphemed. The beast made war with the saints and gained authority over every tribe, tongue, and nation. War against the saints. Revelation 13:8 says, all who dwell on the earth shall worship him. Those whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So, in other words, those who are not God's called, faithful, and chosen. The beast will capture and kill the people of God, we read in Revelation 13. There will also be another beast, a religious beast, which, by the way, all the Reformed confessions have always identified as the papacy. The papacy is Antichrist in the sense that the Pope claims to be the Holy Father. Now, Jesus said, call no one on earth Father. You have only one Father in heaven. And Jesus said, no one is good except God alone. The Pope is called His Holiness and Holy Father. Now, in the Bible, Holy Father is only used, addressed to God the Father by our Lord Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, Holy Father. So this is pretty blasphemous. But just if you missed that, he's called the Vicar of Christ, meaning the mouthpiece of Christ on earth. And he claims to have the triple crown of St. Peter. He rules on earth, he rules in heaven, he rules, in fact, spiritually, temporally, and in heaven. And he has the keys of heaven and hell. He has the keys of death and hell and Hades. Imagine it. He can choose who goes to heaven, he can choose who goes to hell, which is why for most of the papacy's history they've been selling indulgences, selling salvation. And he will also have worldwide authority, this religious beast. And he causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, Satan. He deceives those who dwell on the earth. The scriptures make it clear that this devilish power will work to bring about a one-world government and a one-world religion. Of course, the World Council Church is one very evident example of a one-world religion attempt. See what's written here? Ocumene, which is ecumenicism, effectively. And, of course, Nelson Mandela is one of the gods of the New World Order. And they've got their idols. They have their religious ceremonies. Now, don't you like this, where you've got Judaism and Christianity put together, and you've got different religious groupings gathering together, and this is His Holiness, the Holy Father, the Vicar of Christ, walking around being, I mean, is that adoration or what? And here, our Papa the Pope just came out of worshipping in the mosque in Jerusalem, and saying that there's no difference between Islam's God and Christian's God. And so you can see there's an enormous amount of religious ecumenicism where people are coming across religious divides. And those who say there's many gods, one God, no God, polygamy, monogamy, polytheism, monotheism, what's the difference? It's all basically the same. You know, easy divorce, no divorce. I mean, it's all basically the same. All religions teach the same thing, right? And idolatry. You might have noticed that the Catholics have changed the Ten Commandments. The second command's gone. You shall not bow down to any idols. That's not there. To make up for that, because the ninth commandments wouldn't sound right, they made the tenth command, you shall not covet, into two. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not covet your neighbor's goods. They made 9 and 10 out of that. And so you can always tell a Catholic when they're giving 10 commands, because number 2 is missing, and they made 9 and 10 out of number 10. And that's interesting. Well, why would the Catholic Church have gotten rid of the second command? Well, I don't know. Do you get the impression there's maybe some idolatry going on in there, that they're bowing down to graven images? They say, no, they're not worshipping them, they're venerating. Well, I don't know. It looks like worshipping to me. In fact, most of us Protestants have great trouble telling the difference between this and idolatry. It pretty much looks the same thing to me. And yes, I'm baby Jesus, Mother Mary. And honestly, in Catholic catechisms, when I went to a Catholic school, they teach you that Jesus must obey his mother. That's why you must pray to Mary. She'll get her son to intercede for you and so on. But what about the Bible saying there's one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus? Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father except by me. Call no man on earth Father. No one is good except God alone. But this man's his holiness. And he's the Holy Father, they say. And he said that the Quran is also the word of God. And Muslims also go to heaven. And all these different religions, polytheism, idolatry, so on, Islam, Buddhism, what's the difference? It's all the same, basically, he says. And does this look idolatrous to you? I don't know. I think this is pretty embarrassing. And not only a one-world government and a one-world religion, but a one-world economic system. All this we get from Romans 13. 1913, the Federal Reserve Bank was formed in America, and they managed to get Woodrow Wilson to sign it, although Woodrow Wilson later said the worst thing he ever did, which is possibly true, along with getting America involved in the First World War and starting the League of Nations, but this would probably be one of the worst. We had Stephen Mitford Goodson as a regular guest here at our Reformation Society, and he was a director of the Southern Reserve Bank. Stephen Mitford Goodson said, the South African Reserve Bank is not South African, it has no reserves, and it isn't a bank. And the Federal Reserve Bank is not federal, it has no reserves, and is no bank. The Federal Reserve Banks are privately run Rothschild enterprises, which basically create money out of nothing. So this isn't me, I'm not an economist, but Stephen Mitford Goodson, director of Southern Reserve Bank for 9 years, he said, and we've got his books next door, Inside the Southern Reserve Bank, here's a whistleblower, History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind. He said, the money they create out of nothing. When a government comes and borrows billions from the Federal Reserve Bank, what they do is they create blips on a computer screen, print off the money. It doesn't exist before they create it. But the interest you pay every year on that loan, that's real. Most of the people are working, slaving to pay off debt. And so he calls the history of central bank and the enslavement of mankind. He also pointed out that when usury was forbidden, and by the way, you recall it, Magna Carta, the Great Charter of 1215, which is the father, grandfather of all bills of rights, mostly dealt with forbidding usury. That's the overwhelming emphasis of Magna Carta. And that when Britain and Europe allowed no usury, no banking charging interests, people worked something like 140 days of the year and they had the rest of the year as holidays, which is why they had this phenomenal building spree of building these great cathedrals over Europe, because they all had all this surplus money and time, because they weren't keeping these cursed banksters afloat with these ridiculous loans that governments take out and so on. So that's another story, but interesting that Revelation 13 speaks of this. Socialism is the philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy. And look no further than SASSA in South Africa, these welfare, BBBEE, which is just a cover for colossal corruption, looting of the country, and as I say, 1,7502 ways to defraud, rape, and pillage your country. Viva gravy train, viva. ANC knows how to steal. And every single government enterprise has been looted, and it's been bailed out to the tunes of billions. And they still want you to pay more. Instead of recovering the money, you've got to increase taxes. My fellow South Africans, the money's all gone. There's nothing left in Treasury. My comrades have stolen it. It's all gone. Now, you, the people of South Africans, pay back the money we stole. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. You can't write ANC without spelling out cancer. ANC is the middle letters of cancer. A cancer is a cell that does no good to the body. It only erodes the body's health and ultimately its life. And so the ANC is a cancer government. And I've been a blood donor, and I learned there that the average human being's got 6 to 7 liters of blood in them. Or was it pints? But the point is, I think it's 7 pints. 7 pints of, so if they're taking 6 pints out of you, you know, you're basically going to die. That's what it's saying. You weren't allowed to give more than a pint a month in blood donating, but they are bleeding us dry. Eskom's bankrupt, SABC's bankrupt, South African Airways bankrupt, Petro SA is bankrupt, Danel's bankrupt, Post Office bankrupt, Prices bankrupt, but nationalising of the Southern Reserve Bank will reaffirm South Africa's sovereignty because they've looted everything else. Thou shalt not steal because the government hates competition. Nobody steals more than the government. If you think that the bank robbers are a problem, you could take all the crime in this country combined. It's nothing compared to what the government steals through corruption. According to the African Union Task Force on Corruption, the Southern government steals 32% of the GDP, gross domestic product, every year. 32% of the GDP. That amounts to trillions. It's beyond comprehension what is being stolen by. And that's not talking about taxation. That's not talking about inflation. Let's just talk about corruption. Harry Truman said you cannot get rich in politics unless you're a crook. And, yep, I think that sums it up. When you've got billionaires in politics who weren't legitimate businessmen beforehand, they're obviously crooks. They aim to destroy the middle class to establish a one world economy. That will destroy much of the middle class through financial crises such as those triggered by the US Reserve Bank selling worthless derivatives. And there's an excellent documentary film made in this inside job, very well done, actually, which is speaking about how trillions were stolen in America by the banks. And you may recall it's the economic collapse of 2008, which cost tens of millions of people their jobs, their savings and homes, which brought Obama to power because whatever party is in power when you have an economic collapse, they will lose the next election. And so Obama and the worthless Democratic Party managed to come in on the basis of the fact that this occurred. It was an October surprise. October 2008 election year, the month before the election, this occurred. It was obviously deliberately triggered, and it made some people fabulously wealthy, but also propelled a worthless nobody into the White House who was able to cause untold chaos to the Christians in the Middle East with his sponsorship of this Arab Spring and toppling of Libya, toppling of Egypt, causing the wars in Syria and all the other chaos out there. But this inside job on just the... And Obama promised in the election that he will bring these people to justice. Well, in fact, as they point out here, the Obama government was the most Wall Street-dominated government in the history of America. That's saying something. Not one Wall Street bankster criminal went to jail. Although in Iceland, they imprisoned both the bankers and the government officials responsible for the crash and so on. But nobody went to jail in Britain. Nobody went to jail in America for destroying the incomes, jobs, and homes of tens of millions of people. Now, Revelation 13, verse 15 says, those who refuse to follow the one world religion will be persecuted and killed. He caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their forehead, so that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, when you get a triple of something, it indicates deity, and six is the number of man. It's basic biblical numerics. And if you're wondering where this number fits in, there's whole books written on that, but throughout the years there have been many interpretations, many applications of these verses. And many focus on how the mark will be placed on the right hand or on the forehead, perhaps by a tattoo, was a common thought in books leading up to about the second half of the 20th century. But now, more recently, as the technology has become available, the general idea is, well, it'll be by a microchip, which, of course, the technology exists. These methods may be possible. You know, your bank transactions are done by a microchip that's under your hand or in your forehead. But the emphasis in Scripture is on a way of thinking and on our actions, because it speaks about the people of God having the name of God on their foreheads and on their hands. And we must have God's law written on our foreheads and on our hands. It doesn't mean we've got to tattoo them. In fact, the Bible forbids tattooing. We're commanded to bind God's law on our hands and on our foreheads. And this surely speaks about having our way of thinking governed by the word of God and having our actions governed by the word of God. Just like we're told in Deuteronomy 6 that we should write God's law on our gates and on our doorposts. Now, you can have some scripture at your doorpost, as we do, but that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about when you come into the gates of a Christian home, farm, ministry, business, it should be evident Jesus Christ is Lord. It should be how it's ordered, how you look after nature, how you treat one another, how you treat God's creatures. All of this should be governed by the law of God. Many people have the mark of the beast in them without any tattoo or microchip. You don't need a microchip or a tattoo to have the mark of the beast. When you allow your way of thinking to be conformed to what the world wants and what have your actions conformed to what Satan wants, then you have the mark. A lot of people have the mark of the beast because they've gone through the state education. They absorb all of the world's music, all of the world's entertainment, and they think and act and have affections in accordance with what the world wants, which is what Satan wants in some cases. Political correctness is America's newest form of intolerance, and it's especially pernicious because it comes disguised as tolerance. It presents itself as fairness, yet attempts to restrict and control people's language with strict codes and rigid rules. You can't say that all right people, all right thinking people agree. All scientists agree, and nobody in their right mind would deny that. And you would have to be an intolerant homophobic bigot to suggest. And, you know, they are totally intolerant, and they will damn to hell anyone who, even if they don't believe in it, anyone who has a different opinion. So I'm not sure that's the way to fight discrimination. I'm not sure silencing people or forcing them to alter their speech is the best method for solving problems that go deeper than speech. Who coined the concept politically correct? Stalin and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They were the ones who talked about politically correct in the Second World War while they were betraying Eastern Europe into the hands of Marxism. That's where political correctness began. Aldous Huxley in 1932 published A Brave New World, and this book describes a future state of human slavery where people live carefree lives in a technologically advanced society subdued by drugs, bombarded with endless stimulations and distractions. 1932. How did he see this coming? Albert Einstein said, "I fear the day the technology will surpass our human interaction. The world will then have a generation of idiots." Imagine people sitting in a magnificent art gallery in front of some of the greatest art, and what are they doing? LOL and whatever on social media. You know, it's just what is going on in people's minds? Not much. The marketing of evil is also something very important, that they have managed to market evil so that many people find evil attractive. Another great book was George Orwell's 1984. George Orwell predicted the manipulation of language into newspeak with thought crimes punished by thought police. The Ministry of Truth uses lies and propaganda to distort all information, news, entertainment, education, and the arts. The Ministry of Plenty controls rationing and ensures starvation. The Ministry of Peace ensures perpetual war, and the Ministry of Love tortures, terrifies, and crushes all dissent and resistance. 1948, he wrote that, predicting about 1984, because he could really see this was happening in Stalin's Soviet Union and throughout all of Eastern Europe. And in fact, this has come to a large part of our world too, including making people unpeople and having them disappear down a memory hole if they commit treason, heresy, and blasphemy to the New World Order by saying something that they shouldn't say. And basically what you've got right now is a whole lot of people trying to remove the foundational pillars of Western civilization by removing Christianity, and the consequence for that are catastrophic and will continue to be even more catastrophic. David Rockefeller famously said, "All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the New World Order." The right major crisis. Well, enter Greta Thunberg, 16-year-old, not a scientist, reads from a script. In fact, she doesn't even talk anything sensible when she doesn't have a script. She gets 24/7 media coverage. But then you get Dr. Judith Curry, a climatologist, who's published over 140 scientific papers and books, says climate change, global warming is a hoax, gets no media coverage. We'll take this Swedish environmental activist who shares anger and frustration, how dare you, and all that sort of thing. She offers no solutions to the economic devastation ideas would cause, She's got passion, but she's got the wrong thesis, but she's a media star. 176 million results. But then you get Boy and Slut, 23-year-old inventor who designed the world's first ocean plastic cleanup at age 16. He leads a group developing advanced technologies to rid the oceans of plastic. His solution involves no economic destruction, no government funding even, lots of passion, but he's got the right thesis, but the media's not interested. He gets 270,000 results in media search versus the 176 million for Greta Thunberg. Now, is the media interested in results, or are they interested in just problems? And, you know, look at this sort of thing. You know, for more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear. She hasn't even been alive that long. How would she know? Entire economic systems are collapsing. Well, no, not really. People are suffering. Well, actually, life standards of living today is better than it's ever been before. People are dying. Mass extinction. Well, actually, world population is at an all-time high. So, but there's all kinds of nonsense. $400 billion are spent every year on this climate change, global warming hoax. Just think how much hunger you could solve for $30 billion a year. And if they would just deal with pollution and plastic in the oceans or things like this. But no, it's all going to governments. When we crossed Bike Bridge in Zimbabwe, what do we have to pay? Carbon tax. Where does that money go? Mugabe's corruption scandal. What does that do to actually improve the environment? Nothing. And this is one big scandal. Tyrannical regimes brainwash children to think they'll die unless government limits your freedoms and controls and propagandizes the child in any way so that any criticism is seen as an attack on a child, not on the issue. And this is an agenda. This is propaganda. Imagine, if you will, a world in which people believe the temperature of the planet can be controlled by giving more money to the government. Yeah, you've got to be pretty dumb for that. Okay, those people who've lived long enough. I remember in the 60s, we're going to run out of oil in 10 years. In the 70s, we can have an ice age in the next 10 years. And that was a big thing. When I was at school, ice age. Ice age is coming. I mean, you know, we're going to be under ice in Rhodesia. Kariba's going to be ice skating rink and all that stuff. Serious, that's what they were saying. In the 80s, acid rain's going to destroy all crops within 10 years. I remember that too. In the 90s, the ozone layer will be destroyed in 10 years. Don't you remember that? The ozone layer is going and we're all going to be burnt to a crisp. And I mean, there's just like, what did they start in the 2000s? The ice caps will have gone 10 years. By 2012, there'll be no ice at the North and South Pole. Al Gore was saying that. Remember? So none of these catastrophes happened, but all of them resulted in vastly more taxes, vastly more regulation, a lot less freedom. So when they come up with whatever it is, you know, it doesn't matter what the crisis is, I don't actually believe them. Because Time Magazine, the big freeze, the cooling of America, how to survive the coming ice age, 1977, how to win the war on global warming. Now, when the same group of experts claimed it was global cooling in 1977, now claim it's global warming, you can see why we are skeptical. Professor R.J. Rushdoony said, men prefer an order that permits sin and forbids freedom. They see God's law as tyranny because it's a control on sin, whereas they prefer controls on freedom and a license to sin. Just take South Africa. In the old South Africa, pornography was illegal. They would search people's luggage coming back from Europe and so on, that making sure it didn't have pornography. They'd even ask you at the airport, do you have any pornography and so on? They'd be searching. They, not just drugs, porn was illegal. Last Temptation of Christ, banned. We could get films like Dirty Harry and so on and have no idea that there was any vile content in it because every blasphemy, every nudity had been cut out of the films. I used to think, growing up, that when people were angry, the mouth moved and no words came out because, you know, you'd see that sometimes. A person looked really angry, but you wouldn't hear what they're saying because they cut that out of the films. We were a country where there was total censorship of blasphemy, pornography, and other kind of vile content and so on. And, of course, in time they got rid of it. Gambling was illegal. If you wanted to gamble, you had to go across the border to Transkei or to Sin City in Botswana to gamble. You couldn't gamble in South Africa. And if you want an abortion, you had to fly off to England to do an abortion and things like that. And so a whole lot of people in this country thought, okay, you know, we might give away our freedoms to a bunch of corrupt criminal Marxist thugs who've been trained by the Cubans and the Soviets as to how to torture people to death and who've tortured their own people to death, assassins and murderers. But, you know, we'll get pornography legal. We'll get abortion legal. We'll be able to gamble. And that was worth selling your children and grandchildren's future down the drain. The average person in this country prefers license to sin than freedom. They don't want freedom. Reverend Erlo Stegan said at the youth conference a few years ago, in my hearing, he said to the youngsters, "You youngsters know nothing about freedom. The only freedom the ANC has given you is the freedom to go to hell. Destroyed your life, destroyed your freedom, bombarded you with all these evils, and you call it freedom." He said, "This is not freedom. Freedom to be murdered, freedom to get AIDS, freedom to go to hell and die." So, to understand some of the new terms, democratic socialism means socialism. Toxic masculinity means a straight white male. Political correctness is censorship, controlling speech. An assault weapon, any gun. They don't have a clue what the difference is between these things. They don't even know the difference between a pistol and a rifle and a revolver. Identify as means pretending to be. Now, identifies as a male or whatever. Pro-choice, legalized murder. Undocumented, illegal, or new voter for the Democrats. News reporting, liberal talking points or propaganda. Climate change, another tax opportunity. Inequality means your money should be theirs. Racist, fascist, Nazi, anyone who disagrees with you. We live in a society where homosexuals lecture us on morals, where transvestites lecture us on human biology, where baby killers lecture us on human rights, and socialists lecture us on economics. I mean, is there any socialist model that has resulted in anything but bankruptcy and chaos? Communism's a failure everywhere. You'll notice people don't flee to Cuba. They don't flee to the Soviet Union. When the Berlin Wall was up, people went fleeing across the Berlin Wall into East Germany. They were going the other way. People don't flee towards socialism. They flee away from socialism. And yet, you've got people so stupid as to want to vote socialism in a country where people are fleeing to.
You vote your way into socialism, but you've got to shoot your way out of it.
Exactly. That's the way it works. But just think of baby killers, like the ANC, lecturing us on human rights. After they legalized abortion, they inaugurated a public holiday called Human Rights Day. Human Rights Day in a country where killing babies is legal. Women's Day after legalized pornography. So you can abuse women for profit, massively increase the rape in the country, but we have a day which we call Women's Rights. Youth Day, you can declare after you've just destroyed the chance of these youth getting a job. Every single year that the ANC's been in power, they've added 1 million more unemployed to the unemployed ranks. We now got over 30 million unemployed in this country. If you add the unemployed with the economically inactive, which they like to distinguish, like what's the difference between economically inactive? Oh, and discouraged work seekers. There's three categories. You've got discouraged work seekers, which is the same thing as unemployed. You've got economically inactive, which is the same thing as unemployed. Then you've got unemployed. If you put that all together, it's over 30 million. Every year, there's another million unemployed. The ANC has destroyed the future of the youth, but they give them a public holiday. We now live in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, governments destroy freedom, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and the banks destroy our economy. That's a pretty good summary. And this is not by accident. This is by design. Top left, you get communism. Top right, you get capitalism. You can see why some of us prefer traditionalism, which looks a whole lot more attractive than these rapacious communist or capitalist extremist models. Now, this isn't Britain. Actual billboard. Imagine a city less crowded. Do your part. Get sterilized. Yay. So, the EU has been saying to the Europeans, stop having children for the environment, overpopulation. But then they've been urging the people from the Muslim Middle East and so on, come to Europe because of our declining population. This is what you call population replacement or genocide. Your great-grandmother might have had 12 kids. Your grandmother probably had 6 kids. Your mother had 2 kids, and you have an abortion and adopt a dog. I mean, this is how societies get killed. Tidal wave tsunami of refugees caused by the Arab Spring of Obama, mind you, destroying and bombing the hell out of countries like Syria. And in Britain, they've got a scandal of monumental proportions where it's been proven that Scotland Yard, the Child Protection Service, and the entire British police force did nothing for 25 years of Muslim rape grooming gangs raping a million British children. And they didn't get involved in every case because they didn't want to be accused of racism or being homophobic bigots or of being Islamophobes and things like this. These are all convicted rapists involved in these. And so when I was born, policemen in Britain looked like this. And these days, the police sort of look like this. And then they march under diversity makes us stronger. Really? It looks pretty much like suicide to me. But and that's, of course, the homosexual diversity. And this is, you know, the same police force who now want to have police chiefs who are gay, transvestite, homosexual, who knows what characters. And in the meantime, ISIS is infiltrating hundreds of thousands of radicals into Europe. So this is how Europe can disappear. One wife, two children, while Muslims can have four wives and 12 children. Outbred, outnumbered, outvoted, out. It only takes a couple of generations for this. It's basic mathematics. If you don't have more than 2.2 children, you don't even replace yourself. In fact, for a society to be healthy, it needs 2.4 children per family. And those who do less than that, in fact, they're contributing to the declining population. So what we've got right now is socialism for Muslim migrants. They don't have to do a job. In fact, they said 80% of the people getting welfare in Europe are Muslim migrants. 80%. The welfare, I don't think welfare is ever acceptable. If governments give people things for free, it's going to create the wrong kind of thing. But if it's allowed for the foreigners, well, it's a magnet to draw in the very worst kind of people that you don't want in any society. It's suicide. And this is what some places in Europe look like. And I remember when I was going on a mission to Sudan, and my four-year-old daughter said to me, "Daddy, don't take any poisoned apples from wicked witches." I thought, that's very good advice at any time. And Europe has taken a poisoned apple from the wicked witch. And this is how all the great civilizations of the past were destroyed. They got lazy, they got decadent, they got into welfare, they're lying around having orgies, watching violent sports, blood sports and so on, and then they were invaded by masses of others, and they were just too lazy, drunk or drugged or whatever to care. And before you know it, this is what happened to Babylon, this is what happened to Egypt, this is what happened to Persia, this happened to Greece, this is what happened to the Roman Empire, and it's now happening to the American and European Empire, if they're not very careful and reverse this. The Muslim world is migrating into the Western world. And so here's the distribution of Christians around the world. Here's Muslims in European countries. And this is several years old. It's increased dramatically in the last 4 years. And here's the increase of Muslims and where they're going. Well, they're going to especially countries with a lot of welfare, like Sweden and Germany. Germany and France both have about 5 million apiece of Muslims. Britain, who didn't have 30,000 Muslims when I was born, 1960, now has over 3 million Muslims in the country. Do you know, more people have come into Great Britain in the last year than moved to Britain between 1066 and 1960, combined. In the last year, more immigrants came into Britain than between 1066 and 1960. I mean, just think of the implications of that. A few Normans came in, including my ancestors, back in 1066, and they made quite an impact. What is the impact going to be of these millions of Muslims a few generations down the road on the character direction of Britain? Fertility rates by country. You can see there's a vast amount of the world dying. They just don't have fertility rates to keep up. And this is how civilizations fall. Don't think that our monuments can't end up just like the ones in Rome and Greece. Yeah. And so no wonder some people at soccer matches are bringing out, this is actually in Poland, where they've got Europa basically kicking out the unwanted guest. Well, in our country, we've got arrogance, nepotism and corruption, or arson, necklacing and communism, however you want to put it. And our country has been taken over by people who think burning, looting, and destroying is just fine. And why would you not want people like these running the show? Only in Africa will thieves be regrouping to loot again, and the youths whose future is being stolen will be celebrating it. You know, the very people who are rioting vote for the very people who've created their problems, and then they vote for them again after rioting because everything's gotten worse for us, but then they'll still vote for the same criminals. To do this once is stupid. To do it twice is terminally insane. To do it six times in a row, I don't know what you can say about that. But we never had riots like this before 1994. I thought we had some problems then, but the problems we had back then pale into insignificance compared to the problems that this government's brought. Because we never had power failures. Never had entire cities and lack of fire. Never had that there's no water in the taps or nonsense like this. And yet, the nonsense that these characters can come out with, and the excuses. I mean, you've heard some of the excuses, you know, everything from wet coal to this conveyor belt wasn't working to sabotage to... They've got no end of excuses on Eskom, and all of them proved to be lies. It's just incompetence. And then you've got the murdering of farmers. And the murders of the farmers in this country is absolutely insane because the farmers are so important, they're protected in other countries. Tremendously protected, especially countries like Switzerland, because they know you can't survive if you don't really look after your farmers. And here there's war on the farmers, including from the government, which is committing suicide. This is one of the few countries in the world that exports food, or used to. In 1994, we had 70,000 commercial farmers who were feeding 100 million people, and our population then was 28 million. So we're feeding effectively four times more than our population. Today, we have something like 26,000 commercial farmers left, and they're feeding 40 million people. The trouble is our population now is 59 million. So we're having to import food for the first time in this country's history. We can't survive on our own food. We need to import food for millions of people. That's disastrous. That's catastrophic. And then you think of the schools. I think our schools are doing more damage than even Hollywood to the morals and the future of our country. Because what are they teaching in our schools? It's just, as I say, change is always one generation away. If we plant the seeds of doubt in our children, religion will go away in a generation. And they are I have been astounded to see that South Africans, when I came to South Africa from Rhodesia, 1977, I was astounded. This was the most Christian country imaginable. Christians are everywhere. The shop shuts on Sunday. You didn't need to lock things. I mean, the country was so safe, so religious, so upright. I felt godless having come from Rhodesia, coming into South Africa in 1977. And I felt such a liberal leftist compared to the average conservative Afrikaner. Today, I've seen like a radical right-winger next to the average Afrikaner who's now turned so left-wing that you just can't believe it. Talking about Oom Nelson and junk like that. And then we've got CSE, Comprehensive Sexuality Education, Dangerous Assault on the Health and Innocence of Children, government-mandated pornographic child abuse in schools. This is shocking and embarrassing for the teachers and for the adults. And this has been given to primary school students. This is absolute child abuse. In almost any country world, this should be child abuse. And this is now mandated by this government. Meanwhile, in Bloemfontein, Mr. Heinkie van der Merwe has been called in for questioning after a worker took a picture of his chickens eating separately. Members of the EFF want him evicted from the 435-hectare farm. This is what it's come to. I mean, this is the kind of idiocy that we now get to, you know, whether it's a Sunday school class on the first day and the way the children sit by their own choice or whatever. It's Animal Farm. Exactly what George Orwell wrote about after visiting the Soviet Union. George Orwell is excellent because he's a communist who saw communism in practice and actually got converted and started to write books against communism. There's nothing like the zeal of a convert. And so George Orwell points out, it's a fairy tale for grown-ups. I mean, that's what communism is. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. When you allow your way of thinking to be conformed to what the world wants, and our actions be conformed to what Satan wants, then we have the mark of the beast. Exodus 23 verse 2 says, "You shall not follow the crowd to the evil." We don't determine the truth by majority vote. It's by the word of God. When Jesus was born, there was no place for him in. Today, there's no room for him in the UN. The important thing for us to see is the big picture. The word of God's warning us of a devilish system that'll seek to impose a one-world government, a one-world religion, and a one-world economic system. It'll further be evidenced by its blasphemies and hostility towards God and his name. Now, what could Revelation 13 be talking about? It'll also be evidenced by its hostility towards believers of the past, those who are in heaven now. As long as I've been a Christian, I've been hearing at missions conferences people damning to hell the early missionaries, including people like David Livingstone and others who won this continent to Christ, over whose bones the churches in Africa are built, and yet at mission conference, criticizing the missionaries of the past. Now, I, right from the start, even before I knew much, thinking, well, I couldn't have done that bad a job. I mean, there's millions of Christians and churches all over Africa. And of course they would have made mistakes. They were the pioneers. They were the first ones there. They had no one to learn from. Would we have even ventured out before there were bridges and roads and purified water and all the rest of it? And here these arrogant, lazy fools criticizing people 100 times better than them for doing things they've never tried to do in situations they don't even understand. But this is the kind of thing you find today, a hostility towards the Christians of the past. Like we're doing so much better. Baby-killing, pornographic society. We are so self-righteous, we can judge previous generations at higher standards than us. We could certainly see that the world is dominated today by many forces working for a one-world government, a one-world interfaith religious system, and a unified economic system. I mean, we can see this. And then there's Hollywood, spewing out a vast amount of blasphemies in a great variety of films, in the most creative ways. And there's an abundance of films which are seeking to rearrange reality and rewrite history by slandering great Christians of the past and making idol-worshipping factories of wicked Marxists to legalize killing of babies. Just take Jennifer Lawrence, who's loved by so many people because of, let's face it, actors act. They pretend to be what they're not. She says, if I meet Trump, it'll end with a martini to the face. Well, here she is cozying up to this rapist pedophile Harvey Weinstein, and I mean, just look at the body language. Harvey Weinstein made her career, as he has for a whole lot of others, and we know what his price was to make a person's career and make them superstars. So, you know, basically, this is prostitution. There's another word for it. This woman, who's made wealthy and famous by people who vote for Donald Trump, she insults the very society that makes it possible, but she sucks up to some lecherous, rapist, pedophile, drug abusing. I mean, the lecherousness of this man. He's been convicted of multiple rape and all the rest of it. I hope they put him away forever. But just all of these stars, who we respect in many cases, or have in the past, they have licked his boots. The United Nations is one of the most visible attempts to create a one-world government. And, of course, you've got the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, otherwise known as the Biased Broadcasting Corporation, and the Clinton News Network, pumping out all kinds of disinformation, lies, and propaganda on a regular order. But if you talk about the New World Order and people ask for proof, we've got shelves here of books documenting the betrayal of China, meaning nationalist China to red China, betrayal of Nicaragua to the Sandinistas, the betrayal of Europe, Wall Street and the rise of Stalin, you name it. The hostility of the United Nations to everything Christian is obvious by the consistent support for nations which persecute the church and their failure to effectively address the targeting of Christian minorities, especially in the Muslim Middle East, where Christians are being genocided in Iraq and Syria by terrorists supported by the West, supported by NATO, supported by the CIA. Christians in Egypt. The disgraceful track record of the United Nations when they have militarily intervened in nations reveals their true character. One of the early books I read in this was The Fearful Master, A Second Look at the United Nations by G. Edward Griffith. The United Nations mission to the Congo in the 1960s, when I was a boy in primary school, the invasion of Katanga, forcing its stable pro-Western Christian state to rejoin the communist chaos of the Congo. The atrocities perpetrated by UN forces against Christian civilians by the UN is well documented in The Fearful Master. Christian Katanga seceded from chaos, bombed by the United Nations, invaded by the United Nations, who bombed their schools, their churches, their hospitals, machine-gunned people, like this man driving a Beetle. How could this be a military threat? Killed his wife and child. All that was left was him and his dog trying to escape into northern Rhodesia at that time from the Congo. The UN did that, Pakistani UN forces. The United Nations' complicity in disarming the general population of Rwanda enabled the Rwandan Holocaust of April-May 1994. Look at this stupid monument outside the UN building. Why is it not, quite aside from the fact there's no revolver in the world with a barrel that long, but why is it a revolver? Why is it not an AK-47? Favorite weapon of terrorists or the military? Why not an RPG? Why not a landmine or something? Why a revolver? This is a policeman's weapon. This is a civilian's weapon. It's not a military weapon. It's a revolver. Why did they choose a revolver? Because they're not after disarming governments. They're just after disarming civilians. And by the way, we've got a model of this in the waterfront. The UN donated to Cape Town. Don't know why it's in Cape Town. But I was in Rwanda in 1995 and saw the result and spoke to people. The UN stood by and failed to save lives under Kofi Annan and under Boutros Ghali. And Kofi Annan was directly responsible. He was at the Security Council at the time. And yet, you know, somehow in the Hotel Rwanda form, they tried to make it out that the UN didn't help because the Europeans were whites and they didn't care about blacks. But actually, the people running the UN operation, they were blacks and they didn't care about Christians. That's the fact. They were happy to help Muslims in Somalia, Bosnia, but they weren't interested in helping Christians in Rwanda. The United Nations actually handed over thousands of Christian refugees from these gates at the soccer stadium, which was a UN military base. They daily had the entire army coming with lists of journalists, teachers, pastors that they wanted, and the UN went to trouble of finding them amongst the 15,000 refugees in stands, brought them out, and they were hacked to death within sight of the UN soldiers. Next day, the entire army came with another list, and they found them and brought them out too, and next day they came with another list, and this happened for weeks. The UN handed over people who had come to them for safety into the hands of mass murderers who killed them within sight, and they did it again the next day. And so you've got one of the worst atrocities happened under the UN watch when General Roméo Dallaire, the Canadian head of the mission there, wanted to storm the, before the genocide began, but he knew it was coming, and he'd warned them 4 months before it started this was going to happen. And he was going to disarm, there was a shipment of 1 million machetes that had come in from China, Red China. And it was in one warehouse. It wasn't yet dispersed throughout the country. So he's going to confiscate the whole lot. Kofi Annan, head of the Security Council, forbade him and told him to stand down. In fact, the testimony that you get from General Roméo Dallaire is damning. This didn't just happen on the UN's watch. The UN enabled it. And there's a lot that we can say about the genocide in Rwanda. 800,000, mostly Christians. Modern statistics have been raised to 1.1 million since they've got the stats. In the Genocide Museum in Kigali, they say it's 1.1 million were slaughtered. I walked knee-deep in corpses in Rwanda, in churches. More people killed with machetes in 6 weeks in Rwanda than have died from nuclear weapons in all of history. And the United Nations stood by and failed to save lives. As Holocaust in Rwanda, the book I wrote, and the British film Shooting Dogs documents, the UN actually handed over thousands of Christian refugees who'd fled to them for protection into the hands of the very mass murderers who slaughtered them within sight of the UN. This is part of what you can see in the Genocide Museum, some of the pictures there. And with most international attention focused on South Africa's volatile Mandela elections, there's no journalist in the rural areas of Rwanda reporting on the massacres there. In fact, there were only two journalists in the whole country, because the rest were in South Africa. General Roméo Dallaire wrote the book Shake Hands with the Devil. And don't you love the subtitle? The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. Not the failure of the UN, the failure of humanity. How's that for taking responsibility? And he was a true believer. He actually believed the UN was there to help. And so he was devastated and wrecked by this. And this is all, I saw this long before. They've now taken the bodies out, but they've just left the clothes in there after cleaning them symbolically. But you can see some of the pictures of some of the people who were killed, because it's so important not to forget the individuals, the faceless victims. Who did the UN help? Not the victims, the Intahambwe. They helped the Intahambwe, who fled when the victims rose up and overthrew them. When they fled into Tanzania and the Congo, the UN poured out billions in aid to help the Itumbi mass murderers who had murdered 800,000 or more Christians. This is the 25th anniversary. These are some of the children of survivors, next generation. As their president, Paul Kagame, says, we don't want any aid. We just want fair trade. Ban the UN, abolished French as a national language, made English the official language, which is quite a slap in the face of France, because France helped and aided the genocide architects before, during and after the genocide. And several of the architects of genocide are living under protection of France right now, despite France having signed the anti-genocide treaty, which is another piece of hypocrisy. Canada also signed it, and they've got some genocidal lunatics of Rwanda living under protection of Justin Trudeau's wicked Marxist government in Canada right now. And when they were asked, the French government, why are you doing this? Why are you helping the people who are doing this genocide? The answer the French foreign minister was, we're holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa. In other words, the Tutsi speak English, the Hutu speak French. So, okay, Hutu might be genocidal maniacs, but they're French-speaking genocidal maniacs. Rwanda today is run by the people, the Davids, who were being killed by Goliath. It took 10 years to get a statement from Kofi Annan on this. And Kofi Annan, the best he could come out with was, the world failed you. Not I failed you, not the UN failed you, the world failed you. That is typical secular humanism, because what is secular humanism? I'm a good person. Nothing's my fault. It's all someone else. It's the system's fault, but not. They don't take personal responsibility. They don't know what repentance is. Kofi Annan, one of the most wicked, evil people on the planet, and yet we had, in this country, even Christians like Sharon Dudley of the ACDP, praising this man like he was one of the greatest gifts to the earth when he died. Mind you, she did the same for Mugabe. So when you have Christian, I understand why a Marxist mass murderer would praise Kofi Annan, but why would a Christian politician praise low-life scum like this? And that's only one of the scandals. I mean, we haven't even spoken about the oil for food scandal and the corruption with his son and the billions he stole, but just the hundreds of thousands of lives that died, not just on his watch, but by his orders. So I knew I had to write this. I've never been sick in my life than when I came out of Rwanda. And this is translated French too. The roles of gun control, media manipulation, liberal church leaders, and the United Nations. And a friend of ours, General Ben Parton, paid for a print run in America to see that one copy of these went to each member of the Congress and the Senate. And then I took the French ones to Paris and ensured that the French government got the French translations of this and broadcasted all over France too, that they must know their governments were complicit accessories to genocide in Rwanda, and they're still protecting genocidal architects in France today. The United Nations involvement in human trafficking has also been well documented and is dramatized in the book and the film The Whistleblower, based on policewoman Catherine Bolkovac's experiences in Bosnia. She went to Bosnia under the UN, she thought, to save and serve women, to care for women. She discovered that the United Nations was running the human trafficking and the prostitution. She rescued two girls who had escaped from, who had been kidnapped from Moldova, which used to be part of the Soviet Union, and they'd been trafficked in there. She rescued them from the pimps, put them under witness protection program, and the UN took them out and gave them back to the pimps who tortured them to death. She, of course, complained up the head of mission. She went to the General Secretary of the United Nations. They put a death threat on her. She had to flee. Today, Catherine Bolkovac lives in Britain under an assumed name under witness protection program. The British judge said she cannot return to her own country because she'll be murdered by the UN for having blown a whistle. She can't even return to America because convinced they can't protect her in America from the United Nations. This is just one example, well documented. And why should the UN not be involved in it? Because what is the United Nations? It's the biggest collection of human traffickers, mass murderers, unelected dictators on the planet. The UN is not a collection of elected governments. It's a bunch of gangsters with flags. These are countries where human trafficking is effectively legal, practiced openly with government approval, which, by the way, you notice includes our country. Because our government, in fact, has tried to legalize prostitution, all this, for the World Cup, remember, 2010. Minister of Justice, police commissioner were asking for it. Members of Parliament, we need to legalise prostitution for the World Cup, which is the same thing as legalising human trafficking, because that's what it is. So no wonder the UN has been running human trafficking, because the people who run the UN are the people who run the human trafficking. And they're the persecutors of the church too. Behind the United Nations, you can discern the manipulations of the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR, the Freemasons, the Bilderbergers, the Rothschilds, they're the banksters, and the Illuminati. Working parallel to the United Nations, you can see the World Council of Churches working for one world religion, which is about as idolatrous as it comes. And of course, you've got some nose-ringed, tie-dyed, transgender, tattooed-up characters calling themselves priests and bishops. So no wonder they're in a mess like that. The interfaith movement is being promoted aggressively by non-governmental organizations, NGOs, charity foundations, prominent politicians worldwide, and by the World Council of Churches, heavily funded by the Bill Gateses and George Soroses of this world. Interesting that the unplanned film came out of that. We have George Soros and Bill Gates behind us. Who do you have behind you? That's what the Planned Parenthood woman says. I thought that's very brave to put that in that form, but that's true. Bill Gates and George Soros are two of the biggest funders of Planned Parenthood and of this kind of New World Order agenda. The three main pillars of the New World Order that the global elite want to bring about are one world economy, a one world government, and a one world religion. And the shorthand for this is globalism. And that's all warned about in Revelation 13. As the United Nations working for one world government, so the World Council Church working for one world religion. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good character. How could you have a group working closely together with Marxists and Muslim persecutors of the church, antichrist pagans, and expect something good to come out of this? First we overlook evil. Then we permit evil. Then we legalize evil. Then we promote evil. Then we celebrate evil. Then we persecute those who are still called evil. Just take one example. In old South Africa, abortion, pornography, and homosexuality were crimes. In the new South Africa, we permitted it. Well, de Klerk overlooked it. Mandela legalized it. Mbeki promoted it. And then we get these characters like Zuma and Ramaphosa celebrating it. And now they're wanting to persecute those who are still called evil. Hate crimes, hate speech bill, and all of that sort of thing. This is the way it works.
Blasphemy was also a crime.
Blasphemy used to be a crime. Now, blasphemy is speaking against the New World Order or criticizing the government. That's blasphemy, treason, heresy to the New World Order. They will make war against the Lamb of God, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, faithful followers. We began with that verse. Are you one of the called, chosen, and faithful followers of the Lord? If so, we've got to be overcoming the New World Order. When the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, attempted to achieve world domination and impose an idolatrous religion on all his subjects, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stood firm. On the plain of Dura, a massive statue of gold, 90 feet high, was set up. It was commanded that all people, all nations, all languages, fall down and worship this golden image set up by Nebuchadnezzar. Whoever does not fall down and worship will be cast immediately in the bits of a burning, fiery furnace. So we read that when all the people heard the sounds of the music, all the nations and peoples and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they stood up straight. They would not prostrate themselves before this idol. They stood up like a sore thumb. They had backbones. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Is it true that you do not serve my gods, that you will not worship my gold image that I've set up? If you do not worship, you'll be immediately cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hand? The answer of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was straightforward. Our God whom we serve is able to save us, and he will. But even if he does not, we still won't bow before your idols, nor will we serve your gods. So the three courageous young men were bound hand and foot, cast in the midst of the fiery furnace. The men who cast them into the furnace were incinerated by the intensity of the blaze. Yet Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego walked unharmed in the midst of the flames, and Nebuchadnezzar saw a fourth person with them, like the Son of God. And the king ordered them, servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here. And all the satraps and administrators and governors and the counselors of the king gathered together, and they saw these men on whom the fire had no power. The hair of the head wasn't singed. Their garments weren't affected. There wasn't even a smell of smoke on them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel. He's delivered his servants who trusted him. They've frustrated the king's word. They've yielded their bodies to be burned, that they would not serve nor worship any god except their own. There is no other God who can deliver like this." Today, they've set up another kind of image. The LGBTQ, you better bow, or they will roast you in the fire of public opinion, destroy your life, have you fired, make sure you don't pass, graduate, whatever. And then they've got other things like, if you won't commit abortion, or so on, we'll prevent you from practicing as a doctor for the next several years. And they've got their ways now. It's like a new inquisition. Within the space of 100 years, one person noticed that depraved men have convinced women that nudity is empowering, virginity is shameful, marriage is bondage, porn is entertaining, casual sex is liberating, and killing babies is a woman's right. Who would have thought this possible? I mean, I would have thought even 30 years ago that would have been completely impossible, even 20 years ago. And yet, this is where we are. That you've got a lot of women thinking all this is, I mean, what is actually destroying them is something to be embraced and celebrated. They want your daughter to be a single mother. They want your son confused about his identity and wearing a dress. They want your wife to divorce you and explore her repressed state. They want you to eat bugs, you to live in a pod. They want you to do nothing but consume media and junk. They want to mold your morality into suicidal altruism. They want you to be politically powerless. They want your very existence to be illegal. They want to turn your back on your own people in exchange for creature comforts. They want you to hate yourself. They want your kids to hate themselves. They want to sit back and watch TV, never worry about what the future holds, and they want apathy to consume your soul until you're nothing but a semi-sentient wallet taxpayer. Is this acceptable? Public education, mandatory vaccines and vaccinations, pharmaceutical-based industrial medicine, which make you sicker, welfare, slavery, prisons, abuse, injustice, ethnic discrimination, attacks on natural sexual identity, prostitution, pedophilia, abortion, all are part of the same diabolical agenda to transform people who should bear the image of God into subjects of Moloch. This is just the... And by the way, this is a statue of kids looking up adoringly at what is obviously a satanic figure. This has been constructed by a city council in America, set up in a public place. Throughout history, there have been others who have attempted to impose their political, religious world on the world. Caesar Nero of Rome commanded everyone in the empire to worship him. They were to place the ashes of the incense that burned before his image on their forehead before they'd be allowed to trade in the marketplace, or they'd be thrown to the lions and killed. Muhammad, the founder of Islam, attempted to impose his religious and political will on all. Men were not permitted to trade in the marketplace until they'd bowed to Mecca. And many would leave some dust on their forehead to indicate that they'd performed their Muslim duty. The Hadith records an incident where Muhammad challenged an old man, "Have you bowed in prayer today?" And the man bent down, picked up some dust and rubbed the dust on his forehead by way of a joke, mimicking the practice of so many others in Arabia at the time. Yet the Hadith records that Muhammad did not have a sense of humor. He ordered this old man executed for a joke. During the French Revolution, there's an attempt to impose a blasphemous secular religion on all. They literally took over Notre Dame and enthroned a prostitute, a well-known prostitute, on the high altar of Notre Dame Cathedral and took it over and turned it into a secular temple. The Soviet Union also attempted to eradicate all expressions of Christianity. Over 49,000 church buildings were confiscated, demolished, or destroyed under the dictatorship of Lenin and Stalin. Tens of millions of Christians were slaughtered in the territories controlled by the Soviet Union to consolidate political control and enforce religious conformity to the atheistic will of the state. Here's some brave person who's put up this billboard. People's Republic of China, 65 million, Soviet Union, 30 million, Cambodia, 2 million, North Korea, 2 million. Let me tell you, their stats are way off. It's a lot more than this. But anyway, brave of them to even mention us, but it's worse than that. I can testify that Africa, they haven't even gotten Ethiopia's numbers in there, let alone Mozambique and Angola's. But they've got 100 years, 100 million killed, communism kills, which is... But what they've done is they've taken those numbers from the Black Book of Communism, according to the communists' own archives. So they've got a source. Why do we never see Gulag survivors? Why do you never see Holodomor survivors from Ukraine parade around, or the news media warning about the danger of radical leftism? Why indeed? I mean, there have been vast amounts on the Nazis, but nothing about the communists who've killed way over 100 million and have oppressed a third of the world's population. But nobody cares about a survivor of the Soviet Holocausts. Holocaust in Rwanda or in Cambodia or Vietnam or North Korea. All of these are examples of how Satan works. From Babel to Babylon, from Rome to the French Revolution, from the Soviet Union to Red China, those who seek to impose a new world order and a one world religion also seek to control the economy, and they pour out blasphemies against God and against his people. And they persecute those who refuse to bow to their political and religious will. They make war on the saints and they attempt to stamp their mark on all they have power over. So how can we resist this new world order? During a mission to Albania, I encountered an example of how resilient believers resist the beast. I was working in Durres. Each day I'd walk down the hill past the Colosseum where Titus was martyred, and a kind Albanian man would greet me each day with ice cream. One day I asked him why he's giving me ice cream. He says, "You come from South Africa. You have a very good country." I remember this. This is 1990. The next day I asked him why he thought South Africans had a great country, and he said, "Because our newspapers were filled with articles attacking you year after year." I was a little puzzled, so he explained the communists controlled the media in Albania. We were one-party dictatorship. So we knew whatever the media said were lies. So if the communists hate you, God must have a great plan for your land. I was impressed at his refusal to be brainwashed by propaganda. Whatever the state media told him, he took a 180-degree position and found out a very accurate rule of thumb. The truth is the exact opposite of what the communist-controlled media says it is. One day I asked the man, how did he come to make ice cream? And the man became very animated. He said, "My father made the best ice cream in Albania. And when the communists took over this country, he called my brothers together. And he explained, this communist scum is going to destroy this country. We must dismantle our machinery, bury it before they come and confiscate it. But before they do, I want you to learn again how to assemble us later when the communists are overthrown." Then he said with great intensity, "Sons, never forget, we are Christians. We are capitalists. We hate communism. We make the best ice cream in Albania." And here was this man over 45 years later, honoring his father as a Christian capitalist making the best ice cream in Albania. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by rivers of water. He brings forth its fruit in season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does prospers. Another great example is from Romania. Communists took over in 1945, and they bullied and intimidated church leaders to line up and come on the platform to endorse communism at a congress of cults. And one after the other, ministers stood up to proclaim that communism was actually Christianity in practice. All Christians must support the Communist Party of Romania. A young Lutheran minister, Richard Vormbrandt, was challenged by his wife, Sabrina, saying, "These ministers are spitting in the face of Christ. Go wipe the shame off." And he said, "But you know, if I do that, you won't have a husband anymore." And she said, "I don't need a coward for a husband." And he went up and he quoted from 2 Corinthians 7:14-18. "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. What fellowship does righteousness have with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? What part is a believer with an unbeliever? What agreement is the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be the God and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be ye separate. Do not touch what is unclean. I will receive you. I'll be a father to you. You shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty." Well, Richard Vormbrandt reported that not long after that, he ended up in jail. And then he said all the other ministers who had compromised and lied and twisted the scriptures in order to please their communist masters, they ended up in the same communist cells in prison as he did, just a bit later. But he said the difference was he was there with a clear conscience. They were tortured by their cowardice and compromise at a key time. The film is out. It's in our library, Tortured for Christ, filmed in actual prisons, where these and actual halls and actual place where these things took place. And as he said, a man really believes not what he recites in his creed, but what he's willing to die for. 14 years in a communist prison could not break his faith. Therefore, do not be partakers together with them. And this is what we're seeking to deal with time and again, to smash cultural Marxism, the insidious attacks which they're trying to push onto our children in schools. Truth sounds like hate to those who hate the truth. Truth is the only thing people won't believe. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. We're called to be different. So, are there any questions? Any comments? Here's an interesting prophecy from William Booth 120 years ago. I consider the chief dangers which confront the coming 7th century will be religion without the Holy Ghost, Christianity without Christ, forgiveness without repentance, salvation without regeneration, politics without God, and heaven without hell. How did he see that coming 120 years ago? So, comments, questions?
Should we pay taxes?
Well, Jesus said, render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what's God's. And of course, he didn't say, render to Caesar everything Caesar asks, but render to Caesar the things that belong to Caesar. There are some legitimate things that, you know, paying for benefit of roads or basic things that they might provide. But surely the Lord didn't mean that we've got to give Caesar everything Caesar demands. If Caesar demands your children, well, children aren't made in the image of God. They've got no right to bring up the children. Children have been made in the image of God and entrusted to the parents. We need to bring them up in the love and the fear of the Lord. We're not to send our children off to the Philistines to be indoctrinated and defiled. And surely it's not right for us to fund abortions and pornography and indoctrination and gender confusion and all the evils that governments might do, or to fund corruption. So render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. The emphasis there is he actually got a coin. So he gets somebody to show him a coin. He had to borrow a coin. So whose image is this in it? Caesar's. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. I mean, that's the emphasis. Today, render unto Caesar everything Caesar asks and give God the coin. I mean, you can see that this the whole tenor of the church has moved from rendering unto God what belongs to God, which is basically everything, and giving a coin to Caesar, to giving Caesar everything, giving God just the coin.
I just want to ask, is there any country that the United Nations have stabilized? That you know of?
Well, I suppose stabilized is an interesting word. I suppose we've had mass murders and destruction that could have been stabilized under some communist or Muslim dictatorship, but they haven't made any country better.
I mean, in 2011, the South Sudanese pound were 4 to the dollar.
Yes.
Now it's last year was 460 to the dollar.
Well, the United Nations didn't help Sudan. I document that in Faith Undefined Sudan. After $2 billion and 10 years of Operation Lifeline Sudan, people are starving at a greater rate than they were when they started. All they've done is extend the war, provide an efficient air service for the Muslim persecutors who were besieged in the south by resupplying their forces who were bombing the villages and doing the scorched earth. So the UN actually did nothing good for Sudan. Similarly in Rwanda, similarly in Somalia, similarly I'd say in Namibia and in the Congo. Crimes that they've done in the Congo. And then I could also add what they did in Bosnia, which include massacres. So no, I can't think of any country where I've been where the UN's been operating that they did any good. And I haven't heard of any place where there were actually an answer.
Yeah, just over the last year in the public spaces, have you noticed the amount of absolute cowardice out there? From business leaders,
yes.
From church leaders, from you name it, from the segments of society. At a time when standing over the limits, when it's now critical, particularly in South Africa, where now it's critical, you're getting people that are, you know, like that pastor, he went to jail first, but the others followed him soon after.
I mean, where do they think cowardice isn't going to keep them out of trouble?
And what's alarming, I don't want to sound hypercritical, but many church leaders and leaders within the Christian community are too scared of losing their ministries.
Yeah, and we used to be afraid of offending God. Now we're more afraid of offending the pagans.
You know what I mean? The thing is, who cares if you lose your ministry? You know, it's supposed to be like that lady told her husband.
Yeah, I don't need a coward as a husband.
No, I don't need cowards as leaders in church. Thank you very much either.
That's true, yeah. Well, it is very, very sad.
I can handle being overrun in a surprise attack or something like that. When people who have been entrusted don't make stands and to make they're in the positions where they can make a difference, hold. You know, they take everybody else down with them.
Yes. Well, if the leader's courageous, it strengthens other people. Exactly. If the leader's a coward, I'm afraid it. And just like when our leaders are corrupt, you can see we've got a corrupt government, and the corruption goes all the way down. The entire society is riddled with corruption. It's shocking, yes. Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly, that is a question. Do you want to ask another one?
Yeah. I think I'd really like to ask, what hope do you offer as someone coming from Rhodesia, when we talk about the old South Africa, which we grew up in. I mean, I remember waking up on a Sunday morning and hearing church bells ringing and all of the things you're talking about. You know, sex shops and prostitutes. So we lived a very sheltered life, a very Christian life. We had religious instruction in schools. And there's so many people that we know that have grown up in that old South Africa that have become completely disillusioned with this country, and they're leaving here in droves, huge amounts.
That's not so bad as the ones who've given over to the other side.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, for the ones that can't leave, because clearly this country is going the same way as them, what hope do you offer the ones that can't leave?
Okay, well, of course, we do often deal with that. So, for example, I would see there's a British economist who's written How Long Can South Africa Survive? And interestingly enough, he wrote a book of the same title in the 80s. And now he wrote more recently. And he basically goes, well, the southern government is falling apart. It's dysfunctional. The country is falling apart. So when they can't pay the bills, the country's going to spiral out of control. And different sections will secede, like the Kingdom of Zululand, Western Cape, he said it's the most chance. Interesting enough, this British economist moved his family and he now lives in the Cape. I think he's somewhere in Table View. So he believes that the Cape will inevitably become a independent republic, and that it's got all the means to do so and be a success. And in fact, we're paying 4 times more taxes than is being spent in our area. Not even saying spent well, but we could cut our taxes in a quarter if we seceded. But in fact, we could do better than that, because most of what they're putting the money in is wasted and corruption and so on anyway. I think we could cut our taxes to 10% without even trying, and we'd do better than we're doing now. And in fact, I think we could survive on less than 1% tax. And I think we could abolish income tax and all the rest of it and just go down to TEAL, total economic activity levy of 1%. And it's been proven that 1% of every bank transaction would be more than enough for everything we need, and we'd still get more tax than we're getting now. The reason is because it's for everything. No exemption for Anglo-American and Old Mutual and all that. If it's 1%, and who's going to mind 1% as the only tax that you pay across the board? And that would be, it would be fairer, and it would be for everyone, and no sales tax, no VAT, no income tax and so on. And 1% TEAL, total economic activity levy, would work better. Plus, if we went into a tax haven in the Western Cape, where no tax, for example, the businesses, we can create jobs. Just look at Singapore, just look at Hong Kong, what they achieved by having no taxation and having tax havens and attracting businesses. I believe that economicness, unfortunately, a lot of our people in Western Cape have been cowards, especially our political leaders, but the people in Western Cape have traditionally voted different from what the national population has. And so we actually think differently, act differently, and we are effectively a different country. In fact, the Zulus just celebrated 200 years of the Zulu Kingdom. Well, the Western Cape's been around for 380 years. We've got a much longer heritage and history. And why should we not be, as a unique people in the Western Cape, our own country? In fact, we existed before there was a Pandokie on what today is Johannesburg or Pretoria. And we had the castle built before they even thought of building anything there. So there's no reason why the Cape shouldn't be independent. And once central government can't pay the bills, there's going to be no reason for people to stay in this ridiculous empire union, which is a creation of the British Empire at the end of the Anglo-Boer War, forcing different entities in. And we didn't exactly have a referendum in 1910 either. It was just forced on us. So nor were we really given a choice on what we wanted in 1994. Of course, the government should have negotiated a total decentralized Swiss model. So I'm thinking, instead of following the footsteps of failure, we should follow the footsteps of success, which would be that what we're going to do is follow models like Switzerland's decentralization model, canton system, where everything's decentralized down to local municipal level, and where we are going to go for an economic model based on total free enterprise like you've got in Singapore and Hong Kong. So, yes, I do see hope for the future, because socialists will bankrupt themselves. Humanists bankrupt themselves emotionally. Everything that you're doing on the leftist side is self-destructive. Evil will destroy the wicked. So if we live clean lives, invest in our families, invest in our future, don't get into debt, don't gamble, live clean lives, the people who are following God's laws are more likely to survive the chaos out there that's been caused by following secular humanism, Marxism, and all the rest. But we need to reclaim our municipalities. And by municipalities, we mean down to a real entity. Not the unicity is one of the worst things ever done. You've got to go back to medieval, a real, genuine community. Nobody should be taxed who doesn't agree to the tax from his own genuine community. And a community has got to be a genuine ethno-linguistic people group of a shared faith on right down to the local level. That's, you know, with the police coming from that community, answerable to that community, that works. In Switzerland, everything's controlled by the local canton, not by the federal government. Central government's got no power. All the power's in the local. So I see long-term future then. You can see there's a resurgence of this. Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia broke away. Czechoslovakia separated. Croatia and Slovenia and Macedonia broke away from Yugoslavia. South Sudan broke away. And which?
There's another one.
Singapore also, 1960s.
Also the Balkans. There's also a referendum going on now.
Yeah,
I can't remember the name.
Macedonia?
No. East of Zagreb.
Yes. I'm not sure exactly. Yugoslavia was one uni-state under one party, but there's actually six republics.
Is that a group that wants to secede?
So, with Brexit and the Trump revolution and a whole lot of other things going on today, I think nationalism is having a resurgence. Communism or internationalism is obviously a failure. And so basically, I see a lot of hope. All over Europe, I can see nationalist parties rising up, you know, the Front National of Marine Le Pen in France, the Freedom Party in Netherlands under Geert Wilders is probably going to be next government there. The Freedom Party also in Austria has taken power and they're starting to evict Muslim clerics who are preaching revolution garbage like this and jihad. So we're seeing Greece finally standing up and protecting their borders and firing on the invaders, which is a refreshing change. So while they're taking a long time to wake up, I do see a resurgence of resistance to centralization and totalitarianism and the New World Order. So, of course, the growth of homeschooling is a great hope. The growth of independent community radio stations, the internet, desktop publishing. So there's a lot of things that have made it accessible now, because while we were born into a lot more stable world, but at that stage, the people like Oppenheimer's controlled all the media in this country. Mm-hmm. But now we're bypassing. You know, we don't need the Argus to get our word out, because we've got social media, we've got desktop publishing, we've got all kinds of other options.
You know, you've ministered and travelled a lot in Africa, and you're familiar with the history and the former colonial history of former colonialist countries in Africa. If you look at the history of these colonies, there's been almost this move where the white Christians have had to flee these countries. And you can use many of these countries as an example, from Angola to Mozambique to Rhodesia.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm asking is that the ones that stayed were in trouble, the ones that left did okay. As someone coming from Rhodesia, I mean, the people that stayed there, the country is almost collapsed.
Yeah.
You don't foresee the same thing happening here, that this country is really in trouble.
Well, it is, but bear in mind that the whole country is in trouble, but the Western Cape doesn't have to. We can go down with the Titanic, or we can launch out in our own lifeboat.
Yeah.
We don't have to go down with the whole country.
What's the likelihood of that happening?
The likelihood?
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's extremely good.
Okay.
Well, just look how...
You don't have any new plans.
I have never considered for a minute leaving South Africa. No. This is my home. All my four grown-up children, son-in-law, two grandchildren, not only living in Cape Town. We don't have any of our family living outside. They're all involved in our work. I'm committed. I believe in the future of the Cape, and I don't believe in the future of South Africa. I think South Africa's going down, but I think the Western Cape can make a going concern and help our neighbours. I think the Kingdom of Zululand's also got a chance. There's a few other groups around. South Africa's going to break into 11 or 14 different sections.
You must remember that South Africa is not a nation. It's a state of many nations.
At least 11, possibly 14 nations.
When they call it the state of the nation address, that's a misnomer.
Totally.
That's a terrible statement. This is a state of many nations. In actual fact, when they refer to South Africa, they should never say the nation of South Africa. They should say things like, this South Africa of many nations.
Yeah.
That's
because
be, that's
biblically,
be,
biblically, a nation is an ethno-linguistic people group of a shared faith. It's a biblical definition. In the Great Commission, our Lord says, make disciples of every ethne. And that's where we get our word ethnic from. It's an ethno-linguistic people group. So, for example, have you ever considered the Hebrews were Hebrews? Even after 400 years in Egypt, they never became Egyptians. We're not geographic accidents. The Hebrews are Hebrews. Didn't matter that they'd been born in Egypt and lived there for 400 and something years, they were still Hebrews. And God deals with people groups as nations too, and we come on to make the disciples of every nation. Then you go to Revelation 5 and you see, and the people of every tribe and language and race and nation worshiping God, and they said. And so even in heaven there will be the distinctions of the different languages and nations. Isn't that interesting? That even the book of Revelation, the nations are mentioned. And the nations will be judged, the nations before God. Now, we are judged as individuals in eternity, but we judge as nations on earth. So you might be a righteous person living in a wicked nation, and you'll suffer the droughts and crime and wars that is the consequence of that nation disobeying Deuteronomy 28 laws and so on. But you might be a wicked person living in a righteous nation and receiving many of the blessings that come from others. So we judge as nations on earth, and we judge as individuals in eternity. But even in eternity, the nations are identifiable, and the language groups. So as a missionary, I've learned about evangelizing and discipling nations. But then they sort of try to, in the next class, you go into ethics, and they try and teach you there is no such thing as nations, and there's only one race, and everyone's the same, and but whites are evil. And we need diversity, which is why we should mix everything together, and so on. But there's so much nonsense with this New World Order business, but the average person isn't impressed with this, because after 70 years of Marxist indoctrination and everything else, the moment they got a chance and the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine wanted independence, Belarus wanted independence, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia declared independence, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, they all broke away. Why? They hadn't lost their sense of national identity, or even after 70 years under this communist hellhole. So I see nations spring up now, and it doesn't matter how they're trying to say, let's all be one Europe, one Africa, one. But a lot of people are going on convinced.
You're talking about South Africa as a nation.
Yes.
A couple of weeks ago, well, in the last week or two, I almost fell off my chair when I saw an opinion piece in the Mail and Guardian of all newspapers or news services, an article saying exactly that South Africa is not can't be unified?
Well, if they wanted to unify it, they're going about it the wrong way. I don't even know if it could have been under best circumstances, but the government's doing everything they can to polarize people anyway.
The only reason why from 1910 to 1994 they were able to unify it was because of the low population and a ruthlessly efficient government.
And because the economy was actually quite healthy and growing at 8% and things like this. But yes, yeah, so it's true. But, well, as somebody said, there's a lot of groups that are talking about Cape Independence. There's Cape Exit, there's UL, United Liberty Alliances, Cape Party, and many others. So, as they've said, if everything was going wonderfully and great and you didn't have to worry about crime and economy and the lights were always on and the water is always in the taps, and we wouldn't be here talking about this. But when everything's going wrong, people are looking for solutions. And, I mean, this is one obvious solution. It's like you don't want to have a divorce, but when you've got an abusive partner and it gets beyond a certain point, at a certain point, it's how much abuse can you take before you say, that's it? Yeah, don't want a divorce, but, I mean, you'd leave me no choice. And when you've got a government that wants to steal your land, demonize you, blames you for everything, and wants you killed and exterminated, well, you know, there's some people can say, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't like that idea of being brutalized, insulted, murdered, and so on. So I'd rather be divorced.
Let's have a good, amicable divorce, and then we'll get on much better in the future.
Good fences can make good neighbors in this case. Yes, right. Because it's a mess. It's an absolute total mess. To think that who would want to send their child to a government university now, quite aside from the fact that there's no real education going on in the classrooms, the riots and the violence and so on that's going on, it's like sending your kid into a war zone. Not just a mental war zone where they're being hit with propaganda and all that, but their physical safety is at stake now. It's absolutely bizarre, the nonsense that these people think are acceptable, normal, and the government encourages. So we've got highly irresponsible politicians who are stirring up people not just to war and genocide, but to complete implosion of everything necessary for civilization. If you don't respect life and don't respect property and don't respect people you disagree with, then you can't have civilization and society. And I've seen this happen in Rwanda, I've seen it happen in Zimbabwe, it's happened in Congo, so... Yes, no, this can't work, but the Western Cape is different. I believe we can break away and break away from the extremely destructive policies of the government. And in fact, it'll inevitably happen because if they can't keep the lights on us, they can't keep the water flowing in the pumps, you see local communities taking over and starting to do things for themselves. In fact, let's face it, we're doing almost everything for ourselves anyway. We get our own boreholes, we get our own generators, we get solar panels, we get our own private security companies. After all, what are we actually paying taxes for? Because this blasted government takes things from us and doesn't give us anything in return except abuse. So at a certain point, people are going to say, no. And even Helen Ziller's talking about tax revolts and things like this. So, interesting.
The problem is, you know, when a South African gets into the voting booth, don't go there.
A lot of them are unfortunately cowards. We've got to believe in our own future. And the future of our own children and grandchildren. Now, I've travelled to 4 continents and I've ministered in 38 countries. I've travelled in 42 countries. And every country's got its problems. And I must say, even though I've travelled the world and I'm very, very comfortable operating all over Africa, Europe and America, I don't want to live anywhere else. If I could go back to Zimbabwe, if we could make it Rhodesia again, yes, that's a wonderful country, but that's been irredeemably destroyed. But it's different here. Remember, there's very few of us up in Rhodesia. The population here is very different, and our history goes back centuries more. Now, by the way, for those who don't know, I was actually born in Cape Town, although I was brought up in Rhodesia. But interesting enough, I'm living in the same suburb where I was born, and all my children have been born in the same city, so that's interesting.
It's exciting times to be alive.
I think it's exciting times to be alive,
What's
indeed.
What's everybody complaining about?
Well, here's another thing. Bad times are good for spiritual work.
Yeah.
Because what's our biggest problem is apathy.
Yes.
And unfortunately, we've still got a lot of apathy out there, but fortunately, people are also open to recognizing, well, why are things not working, and why is it that... I mean, we were promised utopia. I sat in the meetings where Desmond Tutu said, back in the 80s, if PW would just abolish apartheid, he could do it with a stroke of a pen. Tomorrow we could be a different country. There'd be no more conflict, there'd be no more riots, there'd be no more sanctions, there'd be no more strikes. We'd all live together in peace and harmony. And you know, he paints a very nice picture, and I thought, that sounds very nice, and I'd like to believe it, but I've travelled all over Mozambique and Angola and so on. I'm not particularly impressed with this. And the ANC comes from this communist mindset, so they won't stop the violence. It'll just increase. If a group come to power through violence, intimidation, and strikes and all that, they're going to stay in power the same way. So if you've got a brat who's screaming, ranting, and raving, you know, mommy, I want the sweet. No, you can't. So it's total temper tantrum. Okay, and then they give them what they want. What are you doing? You're rewarding bad behavior and you're encouraging more bad behavior. So the British told Mugabe, you've got to obey these rules, no intimidation, et cetera. And if you do intimidation, if you do any atrocities, if you do any cheating, then you'll be disqualified from the elections. So Mugabe breaks all the rules, murders hordes of people, blows up busloads of people, keeps out tens of thousands of us guerrillas, murders hordes of others, including people running for elections. And Lord Soames, this worthless son-in-law of Winston Churchill, says, oh, well. And he still gives the country over to Mugabe, although by rights, according to Langstown's agreement, he should have disqualified him totally. I mean, that was their sworn promise before the entire population. The British were there to ensure free and fair elections. And I hand it over to the guy who, you know, it's like you've got an Olympic race, you shoot several of the other participants, you trip up others, you stab some other people, you plant some landmines in other guys' ways, you hack down others while they're getting to finish lines and so on, and then you cross and they say, well, and they still give them the gold medal. Yeah. It's that kind of thing. Well, Mugabe realized the important thing is not obeying the rules, it's just winning the election. And because that's what the British allowed in 1980, that's how he stayed in power since. Oh, so the important thing isn't obeying the rules. The important thing is winning the election. Even if you've got to kill, bludgeon, and massacre a whole bunch of people to do it, as long as you win, you get to stay. And even when he lost in 2008, he annulled the election and then had another one, and this time bludgeoned the people until the opposition pulled out, literally, because, I mean, they were having their arms and legs broken and things like that. So the same thing here in this country. They reward the ANC bunch of mass-murdering thugs, and they think that getting them into power is going to make them behave themselves. And you put a police uniform on a criminal and you call him the police commissioner, he's suddenly going to become honest and up on law and order. And surprise, surprise, every police commissioner we've had has turned out to be a gangster and a criminal. And people are actually surprised. Well, I must admit, there's nothing this government's done that surprised me. Nothing. I mean, Helen Ziller might be shocked, but she has a black sash. She actually fought for the ANC to come to power. And so she's genuinely disappointed because she really expected something good of these people. I've worked with Marxists most of my life. Nothing the ANC's done has surprised me one bit. They've behaved just like communists. That's why we've got a book here on the shelves called You Can Trust the Communists to be Communists, which means they're always going to lie, steal, cheat, all the rest. So, you know, once you understand the Marxists, and what did they say? Lenin said, treaties are like pie crusts made to be broken. To tell the truth is a petty bourgeois habit, but to lie and to lie convincingly is a sign of superior intelligence. Now, why would you try and have negotiations with people who think lying is an art form to be perfected? And that's it. That's what we're dealing with the Marxists. They will lie on every level. They will expect you to keep your side of the bargain. They'll never keep their side of the bargain. And then it doesn't matter what they've promised. They break all those promises and they carry on. And unfortunately, we've got enough people in this country with either bad memories or inability to think and connect the dots to keep voting for these creeps. That's assuming that the elections are in any way reflective of what people are voting. But I'm thinking if you control the schools and the mass media, you're able to brainwash enough people that they can't even think straight. I mean, the Marxists have proved that. So I don't know if they won in 1994, because I don't think something like... I don't even think 18% of the votes were counted.
There wasn't even a voters' roll. How can you have an election without a voters' roll?
Well, we had 104% voter turnout. And they still found containers, meaning pentechnicon containers full of uncounted ballots, which were just incinerated because they didn't even open them because they said this could upset the results. But the first democratic election in South Africa, they didn't count 18% of the votes. They ran out of time. They'd invited the people to Mandela's coronation and enthronement or whatever it was, and they had to come out with a result. And so even the head of the IEC, Independent Electoral Commission, he said, we extrapolated and did horse trading. So they didn't even count most of the votes. So, you know, but whether the ANC won that first one or not, after that, that's right. It's not who votes that counts. It's who counts the votes, said Joseph Stalin. Yes.
Could you neatly unpack the New World Order in a global type of talk? Your take on Jared Kushner? The talks going on at the moment that Donald Trump is leading them into the Middle East.
Yes.
Well, where do you see things going?
I'm very disappointed about that because Donald Trump's done a lot of good things, and as a candidate, his promises were very clear: no more useless wars, no more foreign wars, no more no-win wars. Bring the troops home, defend our own borders. Don't be involved in the Middle East. He particularly was critical about being involved in Syria, that what a worthless, useless war that Obama got us into, and he's going to get us out. But of course he did warn about the deep state and the swamp, and the fact is he hasn't managed to drain the swamp that much, and the deep state's still there and seeking to undermine. And I think it's extremely disappointing that he's allowed himself to get sucked into more meddling in the Middle East, because you know, before 9/11 and before America's wars, which he said in his last State of the Union address, has cost $7 trillion, which is beyond mind-boggling what they're talking about, $7 trillion. And tens of thousands of broken bodies and thousands of American lives. And he's not even counting the millions of people who've died in the Middle East from America's involvement in the war and the destabilizing of it.
If you fast-forward things, Peter, where you think...
I think this is a great mistake. America shouldn't be involved at all. Everything America does in the Middle East is counterproductive and makes more enemies, and it's not for America's interests. They don't need to be involved there.
Might you think that he is the right person placed in that specific position at the right time to instigate a shift in Satan's angels exposed, perhaps?
What do you think? I'm not following exactly.
Meaning that you've got a shift between the Democrats mm-hmm. into Republican space.
Yes.
You've got his daughter married to Jared Kushner, that is going to push the agenda of keeping a type of a peace agenda in the Middle East.
But what's it got to do with America?
That's what I'm asking you. What is your take?
I think, you see, Israel...
And why is he involved?
Okay, Israel gets billions and billions of dollars foreign aid every year from America, and billions more from Germany. So, in fact, the little state of Israel gets more foreign aid than every other country in the world combined. If you took all of history, even though Israel only came into existence in 1948, the present state, they have gotten more foreign aid than all other countries in all of history have gotten foreign aid combined. And that gives them a lot of lobby power. And they buy up parties in South Africa, like the ACDP. They buy up, we've said that they're their biggest supporters. They buy up magazines like Joy Magazine. They buy up in America, they buy up whole churches. They've got people like John Hagee, who has this massive church, and he's an agent of influence for Israel, and there's others who... The Israel lobby is so big that without the Israel lobby, they can destroy any politician. In fact, there's a book out by an American congressman called For Fear of the Jews, quoting from Jesus in John 8, that the Israel lobby has so much political power, especially in the United States, that basically it's a tail wagging the dog. The little state of Israel can buy the politicians of America, or at least intimidate them into behaving themselves. So America's gotten involved in wars in the Middle East that's not in the interest of the United States, but it's in the interests of the state of Israel in the Middle East. And that's made America a colossal amount of enemies, brought vast amount of terrorism to America's shores. And I think it's extremely unwise. It's so bad that one little country can buy up so many politicians all over the world and sway international policy and cause international wars. Sorry?
You don't think your son-in-law will land the peace deal that actually sort out the issues?
Well, it might, but it. I know it's got the support of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and some other
allies.
Exactly.
You just remember,
yes.
The US has got massive agreements with Saudi Arabia.
Yes, and they benefit.
The American military upholds the House of Saud.
Yes.
So.
Totally, yes.
Yeah, it has for the last 45 years. No. No,
more than
since
that.
The 70s, since
longer
the 70s,
than that, yeah.
Since the 30s.
In fact, you can go back to FDR. FDR went on the USS Quincy and met King Faisal and arranged things before the during the Second World War, helping to arrange things.
America's military will uphold the House of Saud, and the Saudis will only price oil in dollars.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Basically, it's very corrupt. But the thing is, there's mind your own business countries like Syria, who are being destabilized for what good reason? No good reason. And the US government admitted, meaning Vice President Biden and the Chief of Staff of the US military, admitted before congressional oversight, it's true we did start ISIS. America started ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
But we started it to overthrow the Syrian government. It got a bit out of control. Ambassador Stevens, the man who got killed in Benghazi, he was the bag man who took the first $500 million to start ISIS. And the money was provided by, I think, Qatar. And so he's the bag man who did it. And so, interesting, he is killed by the very people he empowered and set up. So the US government under Obama set up not just Al-Qaeda, but they set up ISIS and a whole bunch of others, Al-Nusra Front and so on. So the this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is something they've admitted before their own Congress, that yes, we did start them, we did fund them, we did train them, we did aid them, we did provide them with weapons, and, but they got out of control. Well, just like providing vast amounts of American weapons to Mexican drug lords got out of control with Fast and Furious and things like this. So the Obama government did a lot of this sort of thing where they tried to disarm the American people, but they're arming Colombian and Mexican drug lords who bring it into American. A whole lot of people get killed, but, you know, gee. But our intentions were good. So we've got to overlook that. This is the problem. It should be illegal for any foreign government to fund, buy, bribe, whatever, people, elected representatives in another country. If what Israel was doing in America was being done by Russia, for example, it would be considered treason. So it's just very bad to get caught up in any. The Bible says don't get involved in another person's troubles and fights. You know, it's like going down the road and picking a fight with a bear or stealing a mother bear of a cubs or grabbing a dog by its ears. You're going to get bitten in the face. So the Israel lobby is very, very, very powerful, extremely corrupt, and they've got no end of billions. And it's in the interests to keep the money flowing. And the way how they keep it flowing from America is buying the politicians who keep voting for the Israel to get billions. And we deluged with these stories about, oh, you know, how successful Israel is. Well, you give me a few billion dollars a year and I can be fairly successful too. It's no country in history has ever needed so much foreign aid. And so they've got enough money to sponsor ministers and editors and so on, South African politicians to come and fly to Israel in 5-star hotel, all expenses paid things, and I've been offered it too. And there's no end of that going on with America. So they've bought ministers, both church ministers, cabinet ministers, everything through. They own a huge amount of the US Congress. I've heard things that something like a third of the US House and Senate are actually in Israel lobby. And then you've got people like Jeffrey Epstein, who was a Mossad agent of influence, who had this pedophilia island, and he had Pedo One, Lolita One, I think they called it, his Lolita Express, that's it. And there were, he'd be just about every congressman and senator. Interestingly enough, Trump never went to his island, but frequent flyer miles were stacked up with Clinton. Clinton went at least 26 times on his, and his pedophile island is occultic sex, orgy, underage, the whole thing. It's about as sick as it comes. But it turns out that this chap, where did he get all his money from and so on? Well, he's been funded by Israel, he's been funded by America to compromise and bribe or blackmail American congressmen that if they won't take the bribes, they'll have to take the blackmail because they've got the dirt on all them. And so that's why I don't know if he killed himself. I don't know if he's dead. I'm not sure that the guy's dead at all. I think they opened the back door and killed someone else in his place. Because there's several people said they don't think the dead body was actually Jeffrey Epstein.
Interesting.
But so it's a very sick system where basically you've got the greatest country in the world owned by a country that's a recipient of their foreign aid, who's using that foreign aid in order to bribe and control that country and get them involved in foreign wars.
You can't make this stuff up.
It's so sordid, sick, and convoluted. But I know about some of this. I called in the whole leadership of the ACDP to ask what is their problem in this boardroom, that they had all this praise for, didn't matter what happened, they're always ready to speak up for Israel. But Christians can get beheaded, churches can get blown up, Christians get bombed up. Said, we've got a Christian political party, why do you never speak up for the persecuted church overseas? And I said, Israel doesn't need your help. Israel's got a foreign affairs ministry. Israel's got a great defense force. They've got a phenomenal air force. They own just about the whole world's media. They don't need the ACDP. I said, why are you so quick to speak up for Israel and you don't say anything for the persecuted church? And he said, Kenneth Mishra said to me, but they're our biggest supporters. And I know they bought up Joy magazine and totally changed. I mean, you read Joy magazine now, you'd swear that it's editors in Tel Aviv.
Lots of your presentation this evening, yes. What is your own eschatological position?
I'm post-millennial. I believe in the eschatology victory. I'm convinced the Lord's not going to return till the Great Commission's fulfilled and the world is thoroughly evangelized and overwhelmingly Christian. So I'm not premill, I'm not dispensational, I'm not a rapture person. I'm convinced the Great Commission will be fulfilled before the Lord returns. That's what's called post-millennial, the eschatology of victory. It's the position of the Puritans, David Livingston, William Carey, Father of Modern Missions, this Jonathan Edwards. The eschatology of victory was the eschatology of the missionaries of the 19th century, overwhelmingly. It was during my doctoral thesis on the 19th century missionary movement that convinced me of the need to be a post-millennial person, because that was the eschatology of the missionaries of the 19th century. The greatest century of missions was inspired by the eschatology of victory. And the 20th century has been dominated by the eschatology of defeat. Premill, pre-trib, dispensational, everything's going to get burned up. Satan's going to destroy it all. All we can do is snatch a few souls from the fire before we get raptured. Because why rearrange deck chairs in the Titanic and why put up wallpaper in a burning building?
So to sum up, you see the church is getting stronger and getting the victory.
Not necessarily in a straight line. I mean, there's dips and ups and downs. But progressively, we're heading towards... In other words, I do not believe we're in the post-Christian era. I believe we're in the pre-Christian era. I believe this is early church history. I don't think we're in the last days. I think we are thousands, if not tens of thousands of years from the end. I believe this is early church history. I don't think we're anywhere close to the end. I think it's delusional that we're the terminal generation, which I used to believe all that when I was a new Christian, you know, the rapture is coming immediately and so on. But when I discovered that the rapture was a heresy cooked up by the Jesuits in order to weaken the Protestant church, and let's face it, 1914, Protestant nations were the superpowers. Germany, Britain, America, South Africa, Netherlands, Protestant, strongest countries in the world. And pessimillennialism, this end times rapture fever business, dispensationalism, got into the works so much so, and dispensationalism, by the way, was also Schofield and so on, funded by unbelieving Jews in order to get Christians to support the idea of getting a state set up in Israel and so on. The Schofield Bible is the first study Bible, vast amount of money put into it by unbelievers, specifically to fund us. And we now have not one single country in the world that can be called truly Christian. There's not a single country in the world that can be called truly Protestant. We ruled the world in 1914, and now we are persecuted minority, effectively. And I see the eschatology as being a key part of it. Of course, the world wars, obviously getting Christians to fight Christians, Protestants to fight Protestants, absolute disaster, catastrophe. And so the 20th century has been the worst century of persecution. So in my books I've been doing, 20th century is the greatest century of persecution, 19th century is the greatest century of missions. The 20th century has been the worst century in the history of the world in terms of death toll, destruction, persecution, church. More Christians were killed in the 20th century than the other 19th centuries combined. So, of course, that's exact opposite evolution. Evolution says everything's getting better, but in fact, people have gotten worse. The 20th century has been a disaster. I'm hoping for a better 21st century than we've just come out of. But that'll only be if the church gets back to the Bible and gets serious about our mission on earth and so on. So I don't believe we're anywhere close to the end. I think we're in the pre-Christian era.
Okay.
That might sound a bit radical if you haven't heard that before. I'm looking for vastly better in the future than what we've come out of. And I know that the 19th century was a phenomenal century of Christian growth, but from my understanding of biblical prophecy, there's vastly greater church growth coming in the future. But the present apostate church must be exposed, and we need to separate from it, because the present church isn't just backslidden. It's overwhelmingly apostate. I mean, as you can see. We've got a few faithful remnants here and there, but the general picture of the big churches is more than compromise. It's health and wealth, name it and claim it, prosperity.
Yeah.
Exact opposite of what Jesus taught.
Yeah.